I've left Rich Loft's name off the slide. He'd be quite mad at me if I don't mention Rich's involvement in this model, and also John Dennis, Henry Tufo, and Paul Fisher. This is ongoing work at NCAR. Aimé Fournier is also working on the spectral element model, and this dates back a number of years. Mark Taylor implemented an explicit shallow water and primitive equations model using spectral elements, and that was based on some work with Mohamed Iskandrani and Professor Haidvogel, and the ocean modeling group. Professor Boyd has also done some work on spectral element ocean models. So this work has been ongoing for at least 10 years, and spectral element techniques really come from the CFD community. So what I'm going to be talking about today is our work on trying to take some of the solver technology, if you will, from the CFD, from incompressible Navier-Stokes, and adapting it to the semi-implicit solver in our 3D spectral element primitive equations core. Now what we did was we went back and last year when we presented at PDs on the sphere, and then last year towards the end of the year, we had implemented an iterative solver and we were using block Jacobi preconditioning. So what I'm going to present are parallel results using the overlapping Schwartz preconditioner, which you can view as a generalization of block Jacobi, really. And again, the overlapping Schwartz techniques, or more generally Schwartz domain decomposition algorithms, have evolved over the past 10, 15 years and come from the numerical analysis community. It's really looking for ways of exploiting parallelism. So Schwartz techniques have seen rapid development, and there are a series of conferences, the domain decomposition conferences, or DD series. So if you're interested in some background, I would really recommend looking at the DD conference series. Well, what I'll talk about, the previous speaker nicely set up the cube sphere and the curve, and writing the equations of motion, shallow water equations, in curvilinear coordinates. So I'll quickly go through that and concentrate on the iterative solver, the preconditioner, and try and point out some of the work that's already been done, draw some analogies. Well, again, quickly, everyone knows this. The primitive equations, this is using a hybrid coordinate, and it's really the formulation used in CCM3. And if you use a spectral transform approach, whether it be a spectral transform or finite differences, finite volumes, finite element, semi-Lagrangian or Eulerian, if you want to implement a semi-implicit time-stepping scheme with the primitive equations, you end up having a choice of solving an elliptic problem for the pressure or the divergence. And really, this is the heart and the key issue when you're looking at solvers and numerical methods. Is if you look at the spectral transform, it's almost ideal. The semi-implicit scheme is trivial, and in fact, this is the reason why, one of the reasons, not the only reason why, you'd like to use a spectral transform. And early on, André Robert in the early 70s, and then Mackenauer and Daly, people showed that you could basically implement semi-implicit time-stepping almost for free. It typically takes, in the sequential code, about 5% of the time to solve this elliptic problem. So it's quite trivial. But on a parallel machine, the movement of data, the so-called array or data transpositions to move the data around, is a huge overhead. And as you increase the number of processors, the communication overhead tends to swamp the cost. So instead of taking 5%, it can take 50% or more, depending on the resolution, whether or not there's physics present. So in other models, you could do, say, vertical eigenmode decomposition and then solve for the generalized pressure in each one of those levels. So that's the approach we're taking. For example, in the Canadian models, this has been done for many years. So finite volume, finite volume, finite difference, or any of the techniques we've seen today and this week. So as the previous speaker showed, if you have a cube sphere, whether or not we haven't introduced the spectral element discretization yet. So whether or not you're using a finite difference, finite volume, or spectral element technique, the cube sphere poses or presents some interesting difficulties, and especially when you're constructing iterative solvers. So that's what I'd like to concentrate on. So cube sphere grid, and we write the equations of motion using the metric tensor, covariant and contravariant components. And again, the previous speaker pointed out the paper by Rancic et al. There's various coordinate transformations you can use. We've adopted the so-called equal angle transformation, so the metric tensor of the transformation is given at the bottom of this slide. Well, other speakers, Aimee will also give some more detail on the basis functions and how a spectral element discretization is put together. But it's a hybrid technique. It's finite elements. Each one of the grid cells that you saw on the previous slide is a quadrilateral. There's a good reason for using quadrilaterals, namely the tensor product basis leads to very fast computations. And again, this is analogous to global grids. People have exploited tensor product solvers for many years. And really what we're trying to do is do that on an element-by-element basis. So again, I can think of the Canadian model. I think there'll be another talk this week about elliptic solvers for that model. The tensor product nature of the basis makes it ideal, and on vector machines, it's actually very hard to beat direct solvers. And here, it's more difficult to construct a direct solver with spectral elements. So really, that's why we're combining an iterative solver with a direct solver. And the direct solver is fast, and it's based on this tensor product basis on each element. So that's the main point I want to emphasize. And for microprocessor cache-based machines, this is also, in a sense, ideal. We're using the PN-PN-2 formulation, which means that we're using a polynomials that differ by degree 2 for the velocity and pressure or G potential expansions, and you can see that in here. So the basis functions are slightly different. We use Gauss-Legendre points and Gauss-Legendre cardinals for the pressure, geopotential expansion, whereas for the velocity, we're using Gauss-Lobato points, and the two polynomial expansions differ by degree 2. But you can also use the PN-PN formulation. One of the reasons for using this formulation is that you avoid some communication because the pressure isn't continuous. We don't enforce continuity of the pressure at element boundaries. This also has some impact on the solver, which I'll show you. So again, standard semi-implicit. We're using 3-time level instead of 2-time level. In principle, there should be no problem using a 2-time level scheme. We're just trying to follow the CCM3 formulation. Now the key step, after we've discretized using the semi-implicit scheme, written here in terms of differences, we integrate by parts. So there's the key step in deriving the Helmholtz problem, and also deriving want to point out in deriving a symmetric Helmholtz problem. So, 2 points here. We've integrated by parts, and we're using the covariant velocity. Don't know if there's a pointer. Here we go. Right here. And you'll see that this is important to do before the discretization in space. So before integrating using Gauss-Lobato and Gaussian quadrature, and before introducing those expansions, we want to use the covariant form. And you'll see that in the next slide. The reason for that is that we then multiply through by the metric here, and then here we have the mass matrix. And the mass matrix is applied to the contravariant velocity. So all the algebra works out, and without going through it, and without going through the proof, the Helmholtz operator, the Helmholtz problem is symmetric positive definite. Also because the determinant of the metric tensor, G and Gij, they both depend on the coordinates. They depend on x1 and x2 in the equiangular coordinate system, but they're symmetric matrices on each element. So no problem. So we can use the conjugate gradient algorithm. Again, that's nothing new. That's a very old algorithm. It just celebrated its 50th anniversary. So very old algorithm, but what's new in a sense is the design, and this has really been the effort in the numerical analysis community and iterative solvers over the past 20, 30 years, is to design a preconditioner that accelerates the convergence. So that preconditioner is that M matrix. A preconditioner can be very simple. It could be a diagonal preconditioner where you simply grab the diagonal of A, and that's quite a trivial inversion, but it may not lead to much of an acceleration. And really, from the point of view of weather and climate, what we're interested in is, can we accelerate the integration rate of the model? So all the costs involved in solving the Helmholtz problem has to lead to an acceleration of the integration rate. Otherwise, you know, we're not doing anything, really not doing anything useful. So the increased time step in a semi-implicit scheme has to overcome the computational cost. And so in designing a preconditioner, that's really what you're concerned about. On parallel machines, especially the machines available now, there's several things you have to be aware of if you're going to use a conjugate gradient algorithm. Probably the number one concern outside of the preconditioner and the communication costs and complexity of the preconditioner are these inner products in step 3 and 7 of the algorithm. Inner products are global sums or global reductions, and the communication networks on existing machines do that. Well, they're quite terrible. They should be done as tree summations and scale as log p, where log p is the number of processors. In fact, if you benchmark and look at current generation machines, it typically scales as log p squared or worse. So if you were to look at a log-log plot, you'd see parabolas or worse. So the time involved in those reductions is significant and can really hurt on machines dominated by latency. So there are variants of this algorithm where these two steps are fused. They're not fused into a single inner product, but rather it's possible to do those two steps in a single vector reduction, so do two summations in one step. That does help, especially in climate codes where there isn't a lot of resolution, there isn't a lot of work to do per processor, so it's much harder at low resolution to hide those costs. Okay. Well, I started out by saying that we, over the past year or so, were using a block Jacobi scheme. Well, from your basic, you should remember from undergraduate numerical analysis, Jacobi or stationary iterations are based on very simple splittings of the coefficient matrix. And Jacobi is just taking a diagonal of the matrix, using that as the implicit part of the splitting, and the rest of the matrix is put on the right-hand side and is treated explicitly. You can also think of these types of iterations really as being analogous to solving a diffusion problem. So just take the heat equation, you want to time step it to steady state, and you can quickly see there's an analogy between these splittings and that type of time stepping. Well, Bloch Jacobi, what does that mean for spectral elements? Well, let me just go back a couple of slides. What do I mean by Bloch Jacobi? Well, this is the global system of equations here. And in effect, this is a global matrix. In finite element terminology, we've done a global assembly, and we have an integral statement of the problem where we're enforcing continuity on element boundaries. And that implies stiffness summation, and in particular for the derivative matrices. The mass matrix, so that means we're adding at element boundaries, in effect. The mass matrix is diagonal, both on the pressure and the velocity grid. But we enforce C0 continuity at element boundaries, and that just means that the diagonals at element boundaries, you add the Gauss weights. So those mass matrices are diagonal, and they consist of the Gaussian quadrature weights. Well, Bloch Jacobi means that we solve this on each element with zero boundary conditions and no communication, no overlap, as you'll see, between elements. Well, overlapping Schwartz generalizes that notion. In an overlapping Schwartz preconditioner, you simply extend the domain by an overlap, and then you restrict the global operator to that overlapping subdomain, solve on that overlapping subdomain, and then just add up all the contributions. And when individual nodes or Gauss points are shared in that overlap, you add the contributions from subdomains, or if you will, processors that own the same degree of freedom. So this is what Paul Fisher and Henry Tufo and were working on an incompressible Navier-Stokes code, a spectral element code, and they're using the same formulation. They're using the PN-PN-2 formulation. So this is a picture taken from one of their papers, and it shows you have several choices in constructing this overlap region. In particular, you could, for example, just do a finite element triangularization. Oh, there's a tongue twister. Standard finite element triangles. But that doesn't necessarily lead to an efficient solver. You're not exploiting tensor product structure, really, which was present in the spectral element basis. So what Paul and Henry did was recognize that they could approximate the spectral element operator, the Laplacian. Again, if you go back a couple of slides, the so-called pseudo-Laplacian, what I've called E here. This shows up in the Stokes problem. But what doesn't appear in a standard Stokes solver are the metric terms. So the G and the GIJ aren't present. And so we can't directly use the Fisher-Tufo-Mullen preconditioner as part of an overlapping Schwartz scheme. We have to worry about these metric terms. In effect, the notation here, I'm using tensor or Einstein notation, the IJs here imply a double summation, So in fact, that's not a separable operator. So not only do we have to worry about these metric terms appearing, but we also have to do or come up with some type of approximation if we want to implement their tensor product solver. Well, their tensor product solver takes the Gauss nodes and goes back to linear finite elements. Again, if you think of the Canadian model, the finite element model that was in use in Environment Canada for many years used chapeau basis functions, linear finite elements. Well, it turns out that in the CFD community, that, again, for the incompressible Navier-Stokes solvers, collaborator Paul Fischer's, Michel Deville, and some of his graduate students, I guess in the early 90s, there's a very good thesis by Walter Kuzi from Lausanne. They showed that linear finite elements give a very, very good approximation to the eigenvalues for the spectral element Laplacian. Now, the nodes here are the Gauss points. So we're doing a finite element approximation where the nodes are the pressure points, and the linear finite elements extend out into the overlap region. So we're really using this idea from Paul and Henry. We're approximating the Laplacian appearing in the Helmholtz operator by using linear finite elements. So this matrix has a very nice triangle. It's a tridiagonal matrix, very simple structure, and the mass matrix is lumped. So it's a diagonal mass matrix. And this is where we recover the tensor product structure. The mass matrix and the stiffness matrix, A, have a generalized eigenvalue decomposition. And all we need to do are store the eigenvector matrices and use those to diagonalize the Laplacian on each overlapping subdomain. I am dropping them. I'm dropping them and approximating. That's the next slide. I am on each spectral element. I have to make some choice, and I can extremize. I can take min maxes. I can take averages. So it's a bit heuristic, but I found that the best approximation is when you combine a max and a min of the metric tensor determinant and the inverse. So what I'm doing, I'm throwing away the cross terms. And this comes from a suggestion by Peter Smolarkiewicz. He's not working with a spectral element model, but in order to derive separable, basically if you want to use spectral or fast diagonalization like solvers, you have to recover separability. And Piotr, in his model, uses a spectral preconditioner and averages metric terms. So this is inspired, I guess, by some of his results. He has had very good results. Well, it's a maximum over the elements. Because G and GIJ depend on the spatial coordinate, I'm just taking max of each over the entire domain, separate. I'm not taking the max of the product. So just look at each element, take max, within looking at an individual element. What I'm plotting here is, what these tables represent are the fast tensor product or fast diagonalization method with zero overlap, an overlap of one, and then the original block Jacobi. Now remember, I didn't make this clear, but the original block Jacobi is quite a large and dense matrix for each element. And that's really one of the problems we faced. is that, say, if you're using 8 by 8 pressure points, it's a 64 by 64 matrix. Whereas in the fast diagonalization method, you just simply have to store those 8 by 8 S matrices, the eigenvalue matrices. So this is really an advantage on cache-based machines. I want to show you the convergence results, but also you can understand why this method performs well on microprocessors simply by remembering that these two matrices are 8 by 8 or number of pressure points by number of pressure points. That's the secret to the performance. Well, as you saw in this plot, I'm using 6 by 6, so the block Jacobi means an inversion of a 36 by 36 matrix. And this actually follows the overlapping Schwartz theory quite well, in that just an overlap of one drops the iteration count. This is the relative residual reduction here. So the number of iterations is dropped by about half. It's not quite as good as block Jacobi yet. But this is test case 5. Sorry, I forgot to mention this is test case 5, and also end up with some performance results for test case 2. But now if you maximize and minimize, you'll notice it's a little more robust, again, through heuristic arguments, but also looking at the eigenvalues of the preconditioner, you do a little better. So now, also as the number of elements goes up, you might expect that approximation is a little better, because that maximum, that combination max-min is a little better. It's a little truer on each element. All right, well, let's look at a plot of the results on a parallel machine. And there's a lot of information condensed into these plots. And we've just, over the past couple of months, implemented the scheme in parallel. This is the original block Jacobi, up to 200 processors. And I have buried in here, I hope I haven't, well, I have the original results with up to about 500 processors. But let me just talk about these results. You get a better picture of what's going on. Down at low processor counts, you see cache effects. This run is shallow water test case 2, but it's run, or the configuration is a stacked shallow water model, so 30 vertical layers. So the Helmholtz problem is different for each layer. We're really trying to emulate what would happen in the primitive equations. Now you have a 64 by 64, 30, I'm just finishing up, 64 by 64 matrix, and it's different for each vertical level. And we store the inverse to compute that inverse before the integration starts. So for low processor counts, this is on our IBM SP at NCAR, you see cache effects and a slowdown. And these are low resolution runs. C56 refers to 8 elements along a cube face edge, and it's the number of degrees of freedom. So 8 elements times 7 gives you 56 degrees of freedom, 6 pressure points. As you go out, as you go to higher processor counts, on the IBM, latency begins to dominate. And I started out by saying this is the real problem with existing machines. You're either hit by latency or you're hit by bandwidth requirements. At such low resolutions, latency is beginning to dominate. And if I showed you up to 500 processors, what happens is that these three curves tend to converge, and that's all due to latency. There's very little work to do, maybe an element or two per processor out at 500 to 1,000 processors, and any of the benefits are lost. Now, the overlapping Schwartz, this is without a coarse solve. They're an improvement, but not that much of an improvement. In fact, things are worse at low resolution. We've removed the cache effects, and these plots are a plot of call it the acceleration factor. It's how much faster the semi-implicit scheme is integrating compared to the explicit formulation. Simply the explicit integration time divided by the semi-implicit integration time. And the extra communication involved in that overlap causes at low resolution the scheme to die off quite a little bit more rapidly. Our biggest win is at the next highest resolution, the C84 run. We've improved things. We're just a little bit better than one with the block Jacobi. Now we're fully two times the integration rate. And then at the slightly higher resolution, well, it's not quite 50% better, but there is an improvement. So for low processor counts and 50 to 100 processors is really what we're looking at, we have an improvement. But we also need a core solver. That's what is likely needed at higher resolutions. So I'll end off there with just a few observations, conclusions. Food for thought, if you're thinking of implementing semi-implicit schemes, as several of the speakers have pointed out, multi-grid might be an option, but again, multi-grid suffers from perhaps the same problem we would suffer with a coarse solver, namely, there's not a lot of parallelism on the coarsest grid. And you have to worry about how to handle that coarse solve. So certainly multi-grid, people have looked at for spectral elements and in other discretization schemes. Direct methods, well, they're expensive in general. With the spectral transform, it was recognized really early on that you could exploit that separable tensor product basis. And that's why it's so beautiful. It's trivial to solve that problem in spectral space. But data transpositions, as we know now, really kill us and tend to dominate. We're trying to combine with spectral elements the best of both worlds and recover that fast tensor product solver structure, but the machines as they exist, as they're being built and delivered to us, really don't handle inner products very well, and that's a concern if you're solving PDEs in parallel. And finally, if you're designing preconditioners, a very good technique is to average or somehow extremize the metric terms to recover the fast tensor product solver structure that you can exploit. Thanks.